If you would open up to Matthew chapter 9. I just want you to, we're going to start in verse 18, and we're going to kind of drop right into the middle of this situation that was already going on. And if you remember, the verses before here, we've just come off of Jesus going to eat in the household of Matthew, the tax collector, also known as Levi, and the people that were there really saying disparaging things about Jesus in terms of, you know, if he was really really somebody, if he was really knew what he was doing, he wouldn't be eating with these sinners and tax collectors. And for Matthew to this be a great reassurance that he is valued before God, that Jesus would sit there and eat with sinners and tax collectors. And, you know, in my mind, I kind of wonder if they thought of tax collectors kind of maybe the way we think of telemarketers, like, oh. But at the same time, to realize there are souls on the other ends of those calls. And yet to see tax collectors had a purpose too. And so then as we came on through there, then in verses 14 through 17, these disciples of John come and ask a question and saying, how come your disciples don't fast? Like, we fast and the Pharisees fast. So why don't your disciples do that? And in the middle of Jesus giving this explanation of all these things, you see verse 18 come. And so let's start there. It says, while Jesus was saying these things to them, talking about to the disciples of John, he says, a synagogue official came and bowed down before him and said, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. I don't know if you've ever had this situation in life where, you know, you're talking about something really, really low on the chain of really importance. I mean, you know, it's like talking about the price of eggs, and then all of a sudden somebody comes in and they tell you, you know what, my loved one just passed away. It's like, you don't care about the price of eggs anymore. Like, that is not important. And so for the disciples of John to be there asking this question, and then in the midst of him making these statements, to have someone who is a ruler in the synagogue, which tells you he's a Jew, which tells you he's a leader, which also tells you he's one who's looked up to among others, come and bow down while you're seeking this answer from Jesus, to bow down before him, and then to make this statement to say, my daughter has just died. I mean, wouldn't that stop you in your tracks? Really, no matter what spiritual question you had asked, whether how good or whatever it is, that question. He says, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. Now, here's what's something. We're all the way in Matthew chapter 9, almost halfway through chapter 9. There has been no story. There has been no inclination. There has been nothing that's given, that's written down about Jesus even having the ability to raise someone from the dead. So what does that tell you about this synagogue official? He has faith that's really strong. I mean, it's one thing whenever you know, okay, somebody has this ability, they've done this before. But this synagogue official has heard enough about Jesus already to go, my daughter has just died. You can come and raise her from the dead. Now, if you were asking a question about, now how come we don't eat? You know, how come your disciples eat, but we don't? Why can we fast? And they're going, all of a sudden he shows up and he's making a statement of faith in terms of going, I know you can raise her from the dead. Now, other gospel accounts go into more details about her. They even tell you this man's name. His name is Jairus. And his little girl is 12 years old. Now, for any of you who had daughters or have daughters, you think about whenever they were 12 years old. I mean, for us, that's about a fifth or a sixth grader. To go, if a fifth or a sixth grader dies, that is quite impactful. Not only on mom and dad, not only on the family beyond that, the community that you're in, other families who have children around the same age, all those things together. And to go, in this point in time, to go, but just come and lay your hand on her and she will live. And whenever you take that in together to say, where did he get this idea? Where does that come from? Right. I mean, this tells you he's heard some things about healing diseases, healing leprosy, other situations we've read through, and going, I know that if you come and put your hand on her, she will live. And you realize, it's amazing to me that Jairus has that kind of faith. And sometimes whenever one of our loved ones passes away, we have a hard time thinking about, you know what, this is not really the end. This is going to go beyond just here and now. And so here he is, and notice the response that he gets from Jesus, verse 19. Jesus got up, which tells you he was sitting down while he taught, which is kind of normal for the first century. But Jesus got up and began to follow him, and so did his disciples. Now, notice Jesus doesn't say, all right, come on, boys, let's go. I mean, somebody comes to you with a statement like that. If you're a disciple, and maybe you didn't have quite the faith of Jairus, what might you want to be there for? I'd like to see that. I mean, I don't think it would take a whole lot of motivation from us to go, if Jesus was here and somebody asked that question and he's following, to go, I don't know what's about to happen, but I want to be there to see it. And some people may already be there and be thinking, this is going to be easy for Jesus. I don't know. I mean, people have an emphatic faith at times, which is definitely something we're trying to draw closer to. And so, as he goes on his way, and you think about going to Jairus' house, like again, that name's given in other accounts. Then comes verse 20. In the midst of already doing something, does this ever happen to you? You're already working on something at home, and then somebody calls you. Does that ever happen? And all of a sudden you get sidetracked, and maybe you get so sidetracked you can't remember what you're originally trying to do anyway. But that's not the case with Jesus. Here he is, and he's on his way, and his disciples are following him, and all of a sudden, this other situation just pops up. Now, how do you normally think of distractions whenever you already have a plan in motion? Sometimes we get irritated, sometimes we get frustrated, and yet I want you to notice the care with which Jesus shows in this situation. Verse 20. And a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. Now, a couple of things to really examine a little bit more closely here. She's been suffering from this hemorrhage for 12 years. Now, this is 2025. Can you imagine suffering a bleeding hemorrhage since 2013? I mean, you would typically think, boy, losing that kind of blood, that would really make you feel pretty weak. And yet here's this woman. She's been suffering like this for 12 years. Now, I want you to realize the lengths to which she goes. Look over at Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. Look at verses 25 and 26. Just a little added detail here. We'll read verse 25 so that we know we're in the exact same point in time, and then 26 to get the detail. A woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. How do you feel with our current medical situations, whenever you're seeking out physicians, you're spending a lot of money, and in the end, you are not getting better, you're actually getting worse And on top of that, now you have less monetarily to be able to pay for other things, including yourself. Now, I just want you to realize the situation this woman is in. Don't just think, I can't believe she's just been hemorrhaging for 12 years and hadn't done anything about it. Matthew just doesn't give you these other details. But to see this woman is not only losing money, especially she's losing the health that she has. Now, she's been going through this hemorrhage for 12 years. I mean, I think we're at a point in time in life now where 12 years is a significant amount of time. And to note, she's still alive, which is saying one thing. But to go through this for 12 years. Now, remember, Jesus is 30 years old whenever he starts his ministry. So, here things are continuing, situations that are ongoing, but I want you to look at this through the lens of the Old Testament. Look back at Leviticus chapter 15. Leviticus chapter 15. These are kind of some intimate details, but I think we need to see them in order to really grasp what's going on in the moment, to really see the power of it. Leviticus chapter 15, look down at verse 25. Now remember, this woman has had this hemorrhage for 12 years. And I'll tell you a little more detail here in a minute. Leviticus 15:25. Now, if a woman has a discharge of her blood many days, not at the period of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond that period of time, all the days of her impure discharge shall continue as though in her menstrual impurity she is unclean. Now, understand, this is Old Covenant law. Old Covenant. So here she is in this hemorrhaging, and I'll tell you the nuts and bolts of this for just a second. There's a way to actually compare Old Testament to New Testament when you look at the Greek language. There was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament that's called the Septuagint. It was translated a few hundred years before Jesus came to earth. Every time that Jesus quotes scripture in the gospel accounts, it's quoted out of the Septuagint. So it tells you how Jesus saw that translation of the Old Testament. So what you can do, you can take Old Testament passages that are written in Greek, and you can compare them to the language that the Gospels are written in, so that you know when things are exact parallels. The Septuagint works off of the number 70, because there were 70 translators. And it was done down in Alexandria, Egypt, if you want to look up some more details on it. So, in thinking about that, the terminology that's used for this situation in the gospel accounts is the exact same terminology that's here in this verse, in these verses to follow. So I want you to know, we're talking about one and the same thing. This is not just kind of like it. This is exactly like the situation at hand. So here she is. She's had this hemorrhage for 12 years. And now, according to the Old Covenant, she's been unclean for 12 years. And I want you to notice what happens because of that. Verse 26. Any bed on which she lies all the days of her discharge shall be to her like her bed at menstruation. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, like her uncleanness at that time. So notice what happens to uncleanness during those times. What was it seen? If you sat on something, it became unclean. And there's washings that went with this. We're not going to read through that aspect. But I want you to notice verse 27. Likewise, whoever touches them shall be unclean, and shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. It says, whoever touches them, even if you touch her, what do you become? Unclean. And you have to bathe and you'll be washed clothes and bathe in order to be clean again. Can you imagine this is quite a difference, right? And so everything she touches is in turn going to become unclean. Now, so here it is in going through this. Here's this woman, 12-year hemorrhage, has been going through this for 12 years. She's paid a lot of doctors. So not only the doctors trying to help, but in turn they're becoming unclean. And they have to bathe and wash their clothes and do all those things. And you kind of imagine for her, it's not as if people are saying, I want to become unclean. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 9. So whenever you get here to verse 20, I tell you those details so that you know the situation at hand. So here she is. I mean, you imagine just going around and touching people. You're going to make them ceremonially unclean. I'll go ahead and tell you this detail if you're wondering. How would anybody ever find out? What would happen? You know, what's going on inside of these people? If you remember the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Covering, it was specifically for the sins that Israel had committed that they were ignorant of. They didn't know of. So there was a day every year where they would offer up these offerings to cover the sins of Israel that they were completely ignorant that it even happened. A lot of these things would be included in those. Right. She wants to go those things. And by the way, just a little quirky detail, Luke's account does not include any of those things about the physicians. just to throw that out there. But here in Matthew chapter 9, if you notice verse 20, he says, and a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years, and notice it does use the word suffering, came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. What would that typically do? That would make Jesus unclean because she's touched even his garment, which Leviticus is very specific to point out. It's as if this has been laid out for years in Leviticus, this story that's about to take place. Then, verse 21, what's going on inside of her? What's she thinking? It says, for she was saying to herself, if I only touch his garment, I will get well. Notice, this is one of those statements. Once again, like Jairus, what's working inside of this woman? A great faith. She's not even saying, if he'll touch me. She's not saying, if he'll say the word. She's just saying, if I can just touch, and if you notice it says, here's, I only touch his garment, I will get well. And for a lady who spent a lot of money, and had only gotten worse, been unclean for 12 years, to go, here I am. If I touch him, that typically would mean that he's going to be unclean. But then notice what happens. Verse 22. But Jesus turning and seeing her said, daughter, take courage. Your faith has made you well. At once the woman was made well. What typically would be, according to Leviticus 15:25-27, would be, if I touch him, he's going to become unclean. But what's really happened? She touched the fringe, she touched his garment, and now what's he saying? You've been made well. It doesn't use the word drain. It says that he felt the power go out of him. When you read through Mark's account, it's kind of the more detailed account. Luke's as well. And so there's more to this story than what Matthew brings up, like you said. In terms of going, you know, it's kind of funny to read in Luke's account. She touches the garment, and they're in this big crowd of people. And Jesus says, somebody touched me. And Peter's like, Lord, they're all around us. Yeah, somebody touched you, all right. We're going through a crowd here. It's almost the way that it comes off. And then he says, no, somebody touched me. I felt the power go out of my body, or go from me, I think is what it says. And so this woman is scared and trembling because she knows Like, I'm not supposed to be going around touching people, but this is the only way to find remedy, to find a cure. And so here, of course, Jesus turning and seeing her, and of course she falls down at Jesus' feet is the details that it gives elsewhere. And so it says, daughter. Now think about that term. For somebody who has been kind of estranged in a sense from being able to go out in public like typical fashion, to not just be called, you know, woman or something along those ways, but say daughter. A familial type of relationship. And why is that there? Notice what he brings out. Brings compassion. But notice the reason. He says, daughter, take courage. Your faith has made you well. Now, Jesus knows it's his power from God. But at the same time, to go, you responding out of faith to me is what gives us this family relationship. Makes you a child of God. In terms of when there's a faith relationship. Now, keep in mind, this is old covenant, so don't try and bring that forward and go, okay, all I got to do is just... But you see what's going on here. And to talk about in that way, in such a tender way, because of faith. I mean, you think, she has expended seemingly almost all of her money and had nothing but loss because of it. And now she says, I have such great faith in Jesus that he doesn't have to say it. He doesn't have to touch me. If I can just touch a garment that he is wearing, I'll be made well. And immediately, if you notice what it says, at once the woman was made well. Notice, there's not a delayed process. There's not, and it took a few years for her to regain her strength in terms of going. And there's another thing, another detail is given in other accounts. She felt it. I mean, it's something that she knew. This has changed. And that's what's kind of amazing to me. Karen, do you have some? Go ahead and read it. Right. She could tell it on the inside. And you realize what's going on here. Faith, and we know it's a medical situation, but I want you to see faith does affect what happens on the inside of us. And we're not talking about the medical side here. We're talking about, you know, it really affects us. It can completely change your attitudes when you turn from fear to faith, when you turn from worry to trust, those kind of things. And so here she is. And the fact of, you think about stepping out on a ledge just to touch a garment and then to be greeted with daughter. Take courage. Your faith has made you well. And it says, and at once the woman was made well. And you just imagine all these disciples who are excited to go to Jairus' house and see what's going to happen with his daughter, who's 12 years old, going, whoa. Then verse 23, now they start pressing back on to Jairus' house. When Jesus came into the official's house and saw the flute players and the crowd in noisy disorder. Now, here's the scene that he comes up on. Jairus has come to him. Now, and you kind of wonder, too, Jairus, how close to Jesus do you think he is whenever this story with the woman takes place? I would think he's pretty close. Like, maybe he's getting to hear that those things. It doesn't say that, but to go, he's right there close by. Then to get to the official's house, and he saw the flute players. Now, don't think about our modern-day flutes with all the fancy mechanisms on them. Something probably more like a recorder or something maybe they just had made out of wood that's hollowed out with holes to play. I don't know if you've ever heard of pan flute, where you basically just... It's a similar thing to like having an old Coke bottle and blowing over the top. You only get one tone per reed, and they rack them together. But here they are, and you think about... Like any kind of music, music can be either uplifting or it can just crush your heart. And here they are, and of course you know the scene because he's already told us that the daughter has died. He says, and the crowd's in noisy disorder. I don't know if you've ever walked into a crowd and somebody has passed away, and it's been long enough to where people are no longer really all that quiet anymore. You know, right in the first moments, there's hardly a word said. But given a little bit of time, people start kind of coming around and a little bit of chatter comes in. So here's the situation. Flute players are playing. There's a noisy, disordered crowd that's there. Verse 24. Here's Jesus' words. He said, leave, for the girl has not died, but is asleep. And what's their response? They all laughed at her. I mean, flat out, they just laugh at her. They laugh at Jesus. They don't laugh at the girl. They laugh at Jesus. I want you to really spend some time to think about that statement, that verse as a whole. Who sees reality and who doesn't? Jesus sees reality. The people, they don't. I mean, here they are mourning at Jairus' house. And Jairus' wife is there. And so, all these things together, Jesus comes up. He says, leave. You guys are just a bunch of noise and just disorder. Leave. And then he tells them why. He says, for the girl has not died. Doesn't the crowd think they know the truth? Doesn't the crowd think, we know what's going on here? And yet, Jesus is the one who truly knows. I wonder how many times when you read through Scripture, we get to a point in life and we're going to have to decide what we're going to do in this situation. And we start thinking of, well, this person here says I should do that, and this other person over here says I should do this. And here's what Jesus says, but man, I don't know about that. And it almost sounds laughable for some people. In a different situation, I can tell you times where there's been a wedding ceremony, and you start reading through the verses in terms of what God expects out of marriage, and I've had the bride and the groom both laugh in reading through those things. Now, it was not here. But to realize, what do you think I knew from that moment on? It's not going to end well for these folks unless there's a major change. And so you notice here of going, do we really see there are times where the statements of Jesus, the commandments of Jesus, and the principles of Jesus, they sound like, how in the world could you expect me to do that? How could I be that forgiving? How could I really show compassion to these people? How could I treat people this way in terms of what's beneficial and good? What if they come back to me and do things that are harmful? And you realize, at what point are we really going to trust Jesus no matter what the situation is? Because here's people who are listening to Jesus, and their response to him is, what a jokester. Now, he tells them to leave. It says, the girl has not died, but is asleep. Now, let me give you another little thought. You know what Jesus is about to do. I don't think I'm giving away anything in the story. How much power does it take for you to typically wake somebody up from being asleep? Depends on who it is and how tired they are. But typically it doesn't take very long, right? The amount of power that it takes us to wake somebody up from a nap, it's just as easy, if not more so, for Jesus to raise somebody from the dead. That should tell us something. The things that we see as concrete, they're not with Jesus. Troubles that are so big, there's nothing we can do to change them. Jesus is not limited the way we are. And so here he is. And remember, Jairus said, you just come and touch her and she'll be raised from the dead. She'll rise. Then, leave, for the girl has not died but is asleep. And they began laughing at him. Now, notice what happens. Verse 25. When the crowd had been sent out, what happened to him? They're sent out. And I kind of, it doesn't really tell you who did the sending out, other than the statement of Jesus. But whoever did the dirty work there says, and when the crowd had been sent out, he entered and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. Now, other gospel accounts tell you a little bit more detail. All the people get sent out. The girl is actually laid in an upper room or a room. And it's only Jairus, Jairus's wife, the little girl who's 12 years old, Peter, James, and John, and Jesus who are in the upper room whenever she's raised from the dead. If you want to laugh at Jesus, do you really get to see what he's going to do? No. You'll never learn it. I want you to, and one more second. I want you to think about this through and through. Sometimes we wonder, how come the Lord is not responding in this situation of my life? And we're going, it's because we've laughed at him and told him we're not going to do it your way. I'm not going to forgive these people. I'm not going to show these ungrateful people grace or kindness or mercy. And so as long as we're not willing to put our faith in him to walk according to his ways, basically we're laughing at him. And he's saying, leave. I'm not going to work this way for you. I'm not going to encourage your distrust. And you go, sometimes this happens in our own lives. Now, sometimes we do it in an ignorant way. And then there are other times where we trust him completely, and then all of a sudden, what do you get to see? You get to see the hand of God at work. And you go, and I know why. It's not because, hey, because of what I did. It's because this is what God does. This is how he responds in times of worry and distress and anxiety. So I'm going to trust him. And then all of a sudden, we find the hand of God at work. Now, if you notice, it says it so simply here in verse 25. He says, but when the crowd had been sent out, he entered and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. You think of just to reach over and take her by the hand. And maybe I'm thinking too far into this, but she's been dead for a while. I'm thinking her hand might be cold. And maybe even stiff. And to think, here's Jesus reaching out for her hand. And then all of a sudden, the girl got up. Now, I just want you to kind of picture this scene and just think of things that you might imagine. Jairus has already gone to Jesus. Jairus's wife is still there with her daughter and this crowd. Do you think she ever thought, if I could just hold my little girl again, that would be wonderful? You don't know about those thoughts. I'm not trying to add something in. But just typical situations. And sometimes situations you think, that could never happen. Or maybe she's the one who said, Jairus, I think it's time to go get Jesus. It doesn't tell you anything in those terms. But who do you know is overjoyed in this moment? The parents. What do you think this is like for Peter, James, and John? I mean, Jairus came and said, you just come and touch her. And sure enough, what does Jesus do? He just touches her hand. No, he's not in there. And like I said, if you read Mark and Luke's account, you'll get those details about who exactly is in that room. So notice where we're at. And to no surprise, verse 26. This news spread throughout all that land. Well, wouldn't you say so? I mean, something like this. Now, here's what's kind of unique. Remember that big old crowd that was outside and the flute players all in noisy disorder who laughed at Jesus whenever he said she's just asleep? It also tells you how certain they were that she was dead, that they laughed. It was not some trick. Whenever that little girl comes out, and whether the crowd later finds out in some way, fashion, form, or fashion, what are they having to deal with? Jesus was right. I was wrong. How often do we need moments like that? Where we go, you know what? I was wrong. And not just an admission of wrong, but going, I need to change the way I think about Jesus. I need to change the way I respond to Jesus. And you realize it doesn't really even bring up the crowd again. Just kind of a side thought. But going, when news spread all over that land, I'm kind of amazed at times because there's only three resurrection stories about Jesus in his ministry. You have this one with Jairus' daughter who's 12 years old. You have the widow in Nain, her only son, who's being carried out to the cemetery or the graveyard. And you have Lazarus, who was already buried. I want you to kind of see the three of them for this. Jairus' daughter had seemingly died not too long ago. You think about the widow of Nain's son has been dead long enough for he's going out to be buried. You think of Lazarus, he's been in the grave for 4 days. It doesn't matter how long it's been. Jesus reigns supreme over death. Do you think we need to know that? When you have a loved one pass away, whenever we draw near to our own death, of going, you know what, he reigns over death. Death has no control over him. Even his own resurrection points to that, doesn't it? Now, news spread throughout all that land. I mean, I can't imagine if I had a loved one and you had faith in Jesus. Maybe that's the alternative side of going, maybe there just weren't that many people that had that kind of faith. But if somebody you really loved passed away, and maybe they were young, you say, I'm going to go talk to Jesus about this. Now, here's the situation at hand. Look at verse 27. You think of all these stories just coming in a row. If you're among these disciples, the things that you're grasping or your eyes are being opened up to are marvelous. Verse 27, as Jesus went on from there, I mean, like, okay, just time to go on. He says, two blind men followed him, crying out, have mercy on us, son of David. What do you pick out in verse 27 that kind of catches your attention? There's a couple of things in there. I want to see if it's the same for you as it is for me. All right, they're blind. The son of David. It says they followed him. How do blind men follow Jesus? Doesn't that seem kind of unique? You would think it would have to be that way, wouldn't you? It's not like they're going, hey, where's he at? I can't see him. But realize there's something within them, even though they can't see what's going on with Jesus, they can still do what? They can still follow. Now, kick back to the previous story. The crowd could see Jesus, but what? They weren't willing to follow. Isn't that something? Now, notice how this continues on. So, these two blind men follow Jesus, crying out, have mercy on us, son of David. We desire mercy. And mercy is a word that's tied to, look, I've done wrong. I need you to show me mercy. And remove the what's going on here. Now, don't think that this means these men were blind because of a sin that they had committed. John 9 goes way out of its way to make sure we understand that principle. Whenever the disciples are following Jesus and they see a man who's born blind, who's not young anymore. He's about 40, I think. And they're on the run already. The people in the temple were trying to kill them at the end of chapter 8 of John. And the disciples say, was this man born blind because of his sins or the sins of his parents? And if you remember, Jesus' response was, neither. This is to show the glory of God in terms of when Jesus was gonna heal him. So just understand those details. Verse 27 here. He says, have mercy on us, son of David. Verse 28. When he entered the house, the blind men came up to him. Notice, they followed him all the way to where? Till he gets into the house. Which tells you, these blind men are better followers than some folks who can see. Now, so don't write people off. I guess that's what I'm really trying to tell you. Then, he says, when he entered the house, the blind men came up to him, and Jesus said to them, notice who does the talking. Jesus said to them, do you believe that I am able to do this? Now, have mercy on us. I mean, have mercy on us, son of David. Which tells you really something here, because son of David, what does that really tie to? Jewish? What's the promise to David? Someone is going to sit on the throne of David forever. And here are these blind men who have heard all the rumblings of the crowds and what they've been saying about Jesus. And their response is, have mercy on us, son of David. You're the future king. Not a lot of people are saying that. Now, Jesus' response is really concerning what? What about faith? Have you noticed a theme through every single one of these stories so far today? Jairus, you just come touch her. Says, she'll raise. The woman with the 12-year hemorrhage, if I just touch a garment that he's wearing, I'll be made well. And to think of these things together, and now you run into these two men who are blind, and Jesus says, do you believe? He says, the statement, do you believe that I'm able to do this? Do you really believe that I can give you your sight back? Or maybe a sight they never had. They said to him, yes, Lord. We do believe that. And we're ready to submit. Now, I want you to think about this, because this is going to be a little bit of a difference here in a second. They say, yes, Lord, we'll submit to you. Yes, we believe you have the ability that you can make us well. And they even call him Lord. Like, we'll submit ourselves to you. Then, verse 29. Then he touched their eyes. Now, you know they didn't see it coming. That's not possible. But for Jesus, and you think about it, if somebody was to touch your eyes. But here it is, Jesus touching their eyes, and there's something about me that makes me want to think two hands, two men, two sets of eyes. Then he touching their eyes saying, then he touched their eyes saying, it shall be done to you according to your faith. If their faith would have been weak, what kind of sight would they have had? Maybe weak at best. If their faith is strong, what kind of sight would they have? Very strong. I can tell you, and I wonder this question. It's maybe not a fantastic question. But I remember after I had LASIK surgery, I had 20/15 vision. That was really fun. I mean, I was seeing stuff I hadn't seen in years. And realized how beautiful my wife really is. And so you start to realize too of going, I never had 20/15 vision all my life before. But after this surgery, it was even better than anything I'd experienced before. And with this kind of statement of saying, it shall be done to you according to your faith. I mean, you know they're going from blind to seeing. They're not going from seeing to seeing better. And you go, for them, wow, what would that be like? I mean, maybe maybe a better illustration is, you know, after cataract surgery, whenever the fog is lifted and you start looking out going, how far out can I see? What's that roadside down there say? And, you know, you start kind of doing that. They're not reading road signs, but I just want you to realize what they're stepping into is so far beyond anything they had grasped or seen before. Then, if you notice verse 30, and their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, see, I don't think it's a pun, but see that no one knows about this. And you realize, here's the instruction. They said, we have all this faith that you can make us see again. And they're even willing to call him Lord. And now they can see so well, and Jesus gives them a stern warning. Now, I don't know about you, when I hear stern, I think in terms of, in no uncertain terms, you understand this is not to be taken lightly, right? So he makes a statement when he says, Jesus sternly warned them, see that no one knows about this. Verse 31, but they went out and spread the news about him throughout all the land. You realize, here's what's really, really at the heart. How often do we have certain aspects of our life that we are so faithful in? We have no doubts whatsoever. Did they have any doubts that Jesus could give them the ability to see? No. But then comes time in other parts of our life where we're told something, hey, don't see that you tell no one about this. And then we let those things kind of fall through the strainer and act like they're not even there. We often, you know, hear that question about why does he tell people not to say anything? And you realize if you want to really think about it, there's other times it kind of gives a better explanation of those kind of questions and making statements of, because the more these things get out, the more crowded it becomes, and it's harder for faithful people to get to him, for all those who are just there to see the show. And so you see those kind of things, and he knows it. And so you want to have access, you know. And so he knows the more these things go out, the bigger the crowds get, the harder it is for people to get to me. And we've already seen stories like that in terms of the paralytic who's let down through the roof. I mean, here they were having great faith. They want to get to Jesus, but it's so cram-packed in the house that he can't get to him. Lois. Right. It's because what they want to do. And you realize, isn't that the same response that we have? Right. Attention to me. In the same sense, whenever we see commandments that we go, I'd rather do it different. Who's it now about? It's about me. And you realize, oh, we're not walking with the Lord. We're saying we want the, oh, yeah, I got great faith that you can do this. And we'll kind of compartmentalize Christ in our lives as opposed to letting him reign over all, which Son of David, this is what he was made to do. And so you see these events as they take place. I hope you kind of take away from this passage in Matthew about realizing our faith response to Jesus is either going to open a door or close a door in our own lives. Jesus is willing to work with us. I want you to realize, did Jesus already know that they weren't going to tell, that they were going to tell everybody? Yet what did he still choose to do? He still healed them. Isn't that something? He already knew. And sometimes we encounter those kind of situations where you go, you know what, here I am, have an opportunity to help someone. They're not going to use it in a great way when it's said and done. And you go, should I still help them? What does that story tell you? Imitate Jesus. And you'll realize it doesn't tell you the whole story. It just tells you they told everybody. Can you imagine how excited they were? And sometimes that gets us too. I mean, I don't know if you've ever known really good news about something, but it really wasn't your news to tell. And we go, "Ooh, I want to tell you because I want to be known as the person who knows stuff." And you go, sometimes we need to be, you know, learn a little lesson here too of going, you know what, this is not my news to tell. If somebody else gets, you know. Don't tell mom we're engaged. And you go, I keep the secret and I'm the one who gets in trouble. Fantastic. Bear the burdens of Christ, Marlene. Just bear the burden. All right. Well, we'll come back next week and we'll start in verse 32. All right. Have a great week.